welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, episode 71. Today we have one of my favorite people in the sport, Lynn St. James. She's just a real kick-ass person, someone who came up at a time where she wasn't the first woman in motor racing, not by any stretch, but I think she was one of the first, if not pretty much the first in North America in the 1980s, who established herself as an enduring professional in road racing. Also got into ovals as well. Lynn is someone who, tough as nails, hell of a fighter. And again, I really respect that about her. She kicked a lot of ass, especially in sports cars. Drove everything from small little tin tops, working her way up into 1980s IMSA GTO and Trans Am, driving for Jack Roush, Ford Motor Company, with those snarling V8 tube frame animals. Had some really interesting teammates along the way, some who helped and some who didn't. She's driven for team owners who are very supportive and those who seemingly worked against her as often as they could. She did some pretty impressive things too, really by aligning herself with a manufacturer, and that's something that, again, in the world of road racing and ovals, isn't something we'd really seen before. She took things another step further by engaging sponsors and signing sponsors that would cater towards the women in the grandstands and watching at home, yet another area where she really made an impact that has influenced every young woman that has followed in those racing disciplines. She also survived one of the craziest crashes I've ever seen back in 1986, which we spoke about quite a bit. I talk about someone not only living through something that you were really surprised to see that everyone got out in one piece, but just went through hell, came back. A really interesting story about that too that she shares with us. So I think the world of Lynn. She's not only done great things for the sport, but she also continues to do great things by trying to help young women move forward, both as drivers, engineers, team managers, or otherwise through her foundation. So altogether, someone who I don't think gets enough credit. Has a fascinating book out as well, so welcome you to look that up and get some more of
Lynn St. James. I'm so happy to have you here on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. I will freely admit that I've been a fan of yours for quite some time, and also freely admit that after taking a look at many of the podcasts I've done so far and realize that it's been a bit of the proverbial sausage fest, I said, all right, we need to fix that, because that's really silly on my part. But all kidding aside, I've always appreciated your career from the standpoint of you demonstrated talent, worked really hard to create opportunities for yourself, and I think turned those opportunities into some pretty amazing results. That is the template that I know that you can apply to almost every really successful race car driver. I don't know if everyone realizes those things about you. So in terms of motivations, even the most basic sense, tell me about where you grew up and if racing was part of the household, part of the culture, or how did that come into your life?
Well, first of all, thank you. I didn't realize you were paying attention, actually.
Well, I'm old.
You never know who's, you know, behind those doors and windows. But I grew up in Ohio, in northeast part of Ohio, Willoughby, Ohio, which is not well known, but east side of Cleveland. And no racing culture, no car culture, other than my mom. My mom really did create a car culture in my life. Mm-hmm. And in a very strange way. I mean, she was a victim of polio as an infant. And so for her, car was everything. I mean, she was really car-centric because she could walk, but she couldn't, you know, we could ride a bike if the car wasn't in the garage. She couldn't. I mean, so it was a case of that car always had to be there. And she was sometimes a little wacko about it, but she taught me how to drive, and that's how I think that's kind of created a foundation that I didn't know was being created.
How old were you when you learned to drive?
I was 15. Yeah, okay. I mean, when I went to get my driver's license, the guy said, "You seem to know what you're doing." You know, I was like, "You're better than most." So that sort of, and then in the 60s, I mean, I grew up in the 60s, and so it was a car culture era of our society. You know, the muscle cars.
Yeah.
And so that also then carried over. And I mean, I went to a girls' school, and so all my friends outside of school were guys, because that means they could meet new girls, because I went to a girls' school. And they were all into cars. And so that kind of helped me sort of be this, I guess, create this fascination and attachment and feeling about a car. And I mean literally a feeling. My mother would talk to me about how a car talks to you and that kind of stuff. So it was kind of not the technical mechanical so much as the sensual kind of you know, sensory things. And so, but again, nowhere to go with it. Nothing, I mean, this made no sense as far as, you know, I also was taught to get a good education and to be, to do the things that are acceptable in society for young girls and women to do at that point.
And I would say going to girls' school while having an appreciation for the automobile in that era, it's an assumption, but that might not have been the natural after-school type of conversation to engage in with your classmates.
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, other than the fact that I had wheels.
Ah, there you go.
So, you know, it's like, hey, Lynn's got a car, you know? So that helped. And, of course, again, because then I could introduce them to guys. So it was an interesting background, but really nothing that connected me to do what I ended up doing. You know, no brothers. My dad was a sheet metal worker that just had a little shop. And so, I mean, there was... The people assume that you, because a lot of people that are in racing, it's a family culture that their parents raced, they went to the races. I mean, the great stories about all of that.
Yeah.
I didn't have that. I just had the car culture part of it, but not the racing part. Didn't really know about racing, except the guys at the gas station were going to the Indy 500, and I said, I want to go. And my mom said, okay, but she had to go with us as... And, you know, sort of the, you know, the escort or the...
What year was that?
That was in 1966.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I went to the Indy 500, which wasn't that far away from Ohio, you know. So I don't think the guys were quite anticipating that they were going to have this 17-year-old and this mother, even though they liked my mom. But so they didn't have tickets yet. They didn't have a place to stay because they weren't planning on worried about where they were going to stay. But we ended up driving around Speedway. And I keep trying to see if I could ever find that house, because we drove around Speedway and they kept getting out of the car, go talk to people, because as happens still today, the homes in Speedway open up their homes, their driveways, their yards or parking lots, and you know, they rent out cots and beds and whatever. And so we ended up sleeping in somebody's garage, out of two cots, my mom and I. And so that was the first time I'd ever been to a big race other than just drag racing, you know, local stuff.
And what was your impression of seeing the cars, seeing the speed? Graham Hill, obviously a good year for him, but this is an era that if we're talking romantics, I think any open wheel fan, if not just American racing fan, has a deep affinity for the 60s in Indianapolis. Your first visit happened to be at a time where, you know, folks younger than you and I would dream to go back, but what did you breathe in? What did you drink in from that?
Well, I loved it, first of all, the sounds and the smells. I mean, the energy, the sounds and the smells were most fascinating. I remember going to the driver's meeting and seeing A.J. Foyt and Mario Andretti. Those were the two, not necessarily Graham Hill at that point, because I didn't follow racing. I didn't know about a lot of that, or the front engine, rear engine. But the cars were so fast. And I remember, like, I kept complaining to the guys, I can't see which car. And they taught me to listen to the motors, to be able to help define which car was going by. So I was starting to already develop some of that sensory, you know, and I'm very good, by the way, of diagnosing something in an engine, whether it's electronic now. I mean, I think it set my ears to that, you know. And of course, that was the year also there was that horrific crash in turn one at the start.
Yeah.
And so they stopped the race, you know, and I was in turn one. And so it was like, oh my God, you know. So I saw the sounds, the smells, the risks, the people, you know. I wasn't allowed in Gasoline Alley because women were not allowed in Gasoline Alley. But the guys got to go in, and so it was just sensory overload, and I'd never seen anything like it, but all I knew was that I loved it. It just resonated with me, but again, nowhere else to go with it.
So what did you take back from Indy within yourself about that experience that either fostered greater interest or set some dreams in motion that might, you know, that took however long to be realized? Did any of that happen then?
No. It just was there, but it didn't resonate enough to figure anything out. So it wasn't until a number of years later, and I fell in love with this guy, moved to Florida. He took me to the 24 Hours of Daytona and the 12 Hours. On our second date, he took me back to the Indy 500, by the way.
Wow.
And then... And even though I was more, to be honest, I was more into him than I was into the race that year. And then we moved to Florida, took me the 24 hours of Daytona and the 12 hours of Sebring, and now I'm seeing road racing for the first time. And I was one of those people, that those crazy people that stands, sits outside turn one at Daytona and overnight with a cooler in a blanket, you know, and watch the whole thing for the whole 24 hours. And that's when I was married now. The guy that I was married to also loved cars. You know, we just sort of, wow, this is so cool. And we saw, besides Rodriguez Brothers and Mario and Roger Penske and Donahue and all those famous people, as we saw real people in the back of the field in Corvettes and Camaros and Porsches, and some of them from South Florida, because, you know, there were a lot of locals.
Lots.
That could, and that's what then triggered, maybe we could actually do this, you know. And so we decided to join the Sports Car Club of America. Then you found out you had to get a competition license. To get a competition license, you have to go to driver school, you know, you find all this other stuff out. And we both decided to pursue this as a hobby. So a lot of people that live in South Florida, they buy boats and, you know, they go water skiing and stuff like that. Well, instead we decided to become racers, and that enabled me to do it. And I was the crew for him when he went to driver's school first. And he saw my excitement, and he said, "You want to do this too?" And I said, "You bet." I said, "I'll make the sandwiches, but I want to be in the race. I want to be in the car, you know." And that was the beginning. And I swear to God, I just say to myself, I never looked back. It, for me, it was kind of like, up to that point, you know, I was like doing everything I was supposed to do. I was a secretary, I was a wife, I was a...
It was a very traditional time.
Yeah.
People fit in, whatever.
That's right, in the
70s. Depending on your color, I mean, it was... Granted, I was born in 1970 and grew up in the 70s, but having been a part of that, young enough to have seen, you know, my mother, my stepmother, my father, you name it, those that I knew, there were, for those who weren't around back then, by and large, there were lanes. And if you were this color or this gender or this gender and color, whatever it happened to be, there are a lot of lanes that people fit into.
Right. And labels and lanes.
Yeah, and it wasn't particularly accepted for you, whomever you were, even economically, to step out of that lane. So that's, again, another thing that's always intrigued me about you is, yeah, this is not the script that most people would have expected been written for you at that time.
On reflection, I now realize that, you know, because I've studied it now, that really the 70s was a strong feminist movement. And I do remember saying, I'm not a feminist, I'm an individualist. I just want to be who I am.
Yeah.
And but yet I also do remember watching Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs in 1973. And I think those kinds of images and examples were planting seeds that I didn't even realize were telling me something internally. But I just know when I drove the race car, which was a Ford Pinto, that was my first race car.
Awesome.
My street car and my race car. And I just know that there was something filled in me for the first time. It was like all this other stuff was stuff that I was doing. I mean, I was happy in what I was doing, but there was something missing. And that missing went away when I got behind the wheel of the race car. And it has filled me ever since. I mean, it's just, it's another piece of who I am. And once you know that and you have a passion, I think it's made me more powerful in every other way too.
Sure.
I mean, I used to be very shy, to be honest, and people that are still alive,
okay.
I know, don't believe me, but there are people that are still alive back then that goes, you know, you gotta be kidding me. Because I would break out in a rash if I had to talk to more than three people at one time. I mean, but when the racing has just sort of created an energy and touched me inside that's just made me a bigger, more powerful, fun, you know, happy person.
So I went to driver's school in a Formula Ford, did well, got my license, did X amount of races, did okay. At no point in time, and it definitely filled a big part inside of me, but I would never be accused of being a good race car driver. So many people go to race car driving school, they even get licensed, they don't necessarily have the aptitude to be more than a club racer. What did you demonstrate in school? What did you learn about yourself in driver's school to realize that, aha, I like this, it's fun, it fills a part of me, and this is something I need to do on a very serious level?
And to me, it was serious just doing it. I didn't have aspirations about a serious level going beyond. I mean, my very first race, which is, it's pretty well known, I lost control of the car down in West Palm Beach, and I drove into a lake. And so, you know, it was very embarrassing, and it was the woman driver, and I mean, yeah. I just lost control of the car. So I had a long time and a lot of reminders of failure, because I remember that was my street car. And so, and every time I turned the fan on, seaweed would come out for months. I mean, I had constant reminders of failure. And I remember saying, maybe I'm not meant to do this. This is exciting and it's filling me, but maybe I'm not good enough. And I remember my husband then, and thank God, I mean, he goes, Lynn, race car drivers just aren't born, you know. He said, how willing are you, how hard are you willing to work?
Yeah.
And so I wasn't all that good. I mean, the second year I won the Florida Regional Championship in Strohm Stock. But I'm not a natural. I know what I'm not, but what I know what I am is I'm the hardest working driver, and I'm so hungry on the racetrack. I have passed cars that had more power, that had more talent, but I wanted that piece of asphalt more than that car did at that time, you know? And I know that, I mean, I know that my desire on the track as well as off the track is what's made the difference in many, many instances throughout my entire career.
That's one of the things I always appreciated about Paul Newman, because he would readily say, same thing. Some race car drivers are born, some of them are taught. I'm taught, and I've had to work so hard at this to get to where I am, wherever that is. But knowing that you had to work to create the craft, hone the craft, what was that process like coming, I don't want to say out of Florida regional racing, but when was that trigger point for you of, this SCCA pro level stuff, or IMSA, Daytona, Sebring, when did that move from learning on the amateur level to, these races I've seen before as a spectator, maybe I could be in them myself?
I think the biggest breakthrough I had, both personally in my brain and then professionally in enabling, was when I got Ford Motor Company as a sponsor in 1981.
Yeah.
There was a legitimation, I became legitimate, I guess. I was a professional race partner, even though I'd been racing in professional races in IMSA, I wasn't getting paid, and I was still having to, stories beyond belief. But, I'd gotten divorced, and so I thought, okay, that enabling factor with my husband and I both racing it was no longer, so I was going to have to figure this out on my own. Is true. In 1978, when I went to the runoffs, I read an article in Car and Driver magazine, and it was about the Ford Mustang, but it had a sidebar, and it was the title of the sidebar was Ford and Feminism, and it talked about Ford Motor Company wanting to provide equal employment opportunities for women in non-traditional areas, as well as selling cars to women. And I chased Ford for 3 years. I mean, I literally, every name I could ever get that worked at Ford Motor Company, they got a letter from me. And in 1981, they signed me. And that transitioned me, now I was a professional race car driver. I was getting paid, and they were paying for my racing. They were telling me when and how and what team and whatever, but that was okay. I was actually, but then it was like, I still wasn't any better than I was the year before. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words, I'm still who I am as far as how much skill and ability I had. But that started to take me to tracks like you're talking about. You know, I'm at Sonoma. I'm at Watkins Glen. I mean, before I had only run Road Atlanta as probably in mid-Ohio. I think because I did the Kelly series, I did get out of the Southeast, but on a rare occasion. And now I'm running the full circuit, and I am with Klaus Ludwig, and who's a German
giant,
yes, and on. I've had wonderful friends that have given me great advice, and every time this guy would tell me, Lynn, remember, every time you climb a mountain and you reach the peak of the mountain, you can take that moment of a breath of enjoying that appreciation, but the problem is you're going to see that when you look around, there's another mountain that you didn't see when you were climbing that mountain. And so then, the mountains became bigger that I was trying to climb, which was, of course, win races and deal with the politics and understand the responsibilities and the media. And, I mean, there was so much to learn. And I had 1-year contract, so there was never a guarantee. And, so by June, you're already worried about the next year. And, I mean, there was an amazing amount of processing of information and learning that I had to try to, conquer. So
we had Jenna Guthrie had obviously made her name and gained a lot of fame within the country for her open wheel exploits. What was it like for you really branching out into sports car racing as your initial, I guess, entry point to this bigger professional world? The amount of just ridiculous sexist nonsense aimed at Janet was clear. What was the experience like on the sports car end, which I've always considered sports car, since there tends to be lesser fame, it's a little more of a family environment. I don't want to assume it was a nicer environment, because I don't know.
No, it really was, actually. I mean, it's more of a family atmosphere, particularly when the Bishops were running IMSA.
Yeah.
And so I was really happy. I never felt, I mean, I shouldn't say never, but I didn't have an overwhelming sense of trying to prove anything to anybody or trying to deal with all of that sexism and everything. I remember watching Janet, when you mentioned that, 77, 78, 79. I got to go to the runoffs in 78 in Sherwood Stock. I mean, I'm like, I'm in this world of aspiration and happiness and challenge and failure and yada yada, but I'm happy. I mean, I'm really comfortable in what I'm doing. I watched Janet at Indy on television, 78, 77, 78, 79, and going, holy cow, they do not want her there.
Mm.
She did, I mean, a couple times I saw her smiling, but most of the time she didn't look like she was having a whole bunch of fun. And I'm going, there ain't no way. You know, I'm like, you know, you go, girl. But I'm like, you know, I got my own mountains over here that I'm climbing, and I'm having a really good time. And so, and I mean, I've had my challenges, but I don't know, somehow it was just different. And I'm going to tell you a story that I've never told anybody.
Really?
Because I met Janet. Actually, we co-drove together in 1979 at the 12 Hours of Sebring. And she was not particularly pleased having me as a co-driver for whatever reason. I mean, it's like, who are you? I'm Janet Guthrie, who's just come from the Indianapolis 500.
Yeah.
And she was at her peak, so I kind of got it. You know, I'm a little local girl from South Florida at Preston, and I convinced Preston Hinn to put me in the car because I would provide tires. Well, because the same size tires on that Ferrari were also on my husband's Corvette, so I didn't tell him they'd be new tires. He got a shitload of tires,
nice.
But I did get Leo Bell to convince him to give me one set of tires, so it saved my butt.
Wow.
But anyway, we finished that race, and Janet and I kind of got to know each other then. But and then we got to know each other again in 1980, before I actually, well, no, 1981, when I had Ford as a sponsor. Janet and I and Kay Bignotti drove from Los Angeles to New York City, or to Washington, D.C., and I went on to New York City on ethanol and alternative fuels for a fleet for Ford Motor Company.
Wow.
It's one of the first things that I had to do for Ford. And so I'm under contract to Ford now. I'm having a car built to run in the Kelly Series, and I'm like more worried, and this is like in March, and the first Kelly race is in April, and I'm kind of, so I'm really,
season's getting busy.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about my race car, but meanwhile, we're also contracted to do this. So we go for a week across country, and I'm the only driver of that fleet. They have these fleet of three little escorts and LN7s or whatever they were, and I'm the only one that drove the whole time, because that's what I do. I love to drive, you know. Janet would drive when we were coming into the cities and doing the things, and the rest of the time she would ride, you know, ride, I guess. And so, but we did get to know each other a little bit. And so at the end of that, I remember asking Janet if I could come meet with her when she lived in New York City at the time. And I did, and she did. I met with her, and I said, I have this really great idea. I said, why don't we team up? And since I've got Ford as a sponsor, and I'm running in the Kelly Series, we would be stronger as a two-car team. I mean, I've paid attention. Two-car teams usually are more successful than, and I'm trying to launch this whole, and I said, you could run for the championship because you have so much more experience than I do, and then I, you know, we'll be a two-car team. And she looked at me and said, why would I do that? I'm like, she said, I'm an Indy driver, and I don't want to do that. I mean, she basically asked me to leave.
Really?
I mean, it was so humiliating, and I was like, I didn't know what to say, you know. I mean, I thought, here I was trying to give her an opportunity, I thought, and I was ready to leverage, you know, my risk, not risk, but leverage what I'd already put together. And I'll just never forget that. She just shut the door on me, basically. And
Do you think it was her owning the famous female race car driver real estate, not wanting competition?
I think it was her anger. She was so angry at what she didn't get.
Mm.
And I think that clouded her. Beyond that, I have no idea. Because I've gotten to know Janet. We've never talked about that. I don't even think she remembers it, to be honest. I remember it vividly.
Sure.
But it was probably a little blip on her throttle, where for me it was, a huge. And, I just know that she was angry. She was angry. I learned that whole week we drove cross country. She was a person that was angry. She's gotten over that, I think, a lot now. But because she felt that she never got a shot, a fair shot. And in reality, she probably didn't, But I just remember that. And I was so deflated from that. And then I just moved on. I mean, it was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to figure this team owner thing out, and run a car by myself against Gene Felton and these really, tough Clay, whatever his last name was. And I mean, there were some good guys that I was running against back in the Kelly series. So anyway.
And you move from there into what I think is a really cool era for you in the early 80s, where you're in IMSA. You move into Trans Am. You're racing, an Aston Martin Nimrod prototype. You have your own team and working with, Camel Lights car. You're in Trans Am. Tell me about the early 80s. We'll get to the mid 80s when the relationship with Roush, I think, is where most folks really started to get to know you as a driver. But tell me about that early stage in the 80s before you got to that mid 80s point. You're driving a lot of things, a lot of cool, interesting things.
Well, most of the time, I had the deal. I drove whatever series and whatever car Ford Motor Company told me to drive. So when it was by myself 1 year, then it was Tom Galloy. I was partnered with him, and they decided that. But none of those included the 24 hours of Daytona and the 12 hours of Sebring. Mm. And those were like my little passion points.
Yeah.
I'm living in South Florida. This is what got me where they cared about me at all. And what do you mean? I have to run the 24 hours of Daytona. So I would put a deal together, and I would call racetracks. I told Michael Prinup this week, before this week, a month ago, and said, I'm going to be here for the Indy race and for the Vintage race. What can I do to help you? And so that's what I do, and I've always done that. I'd call John Bishop, or I'd call Mark Raffoff, or even Charlie, what do you guys got? And I want to run with you. And there were deals that were, and I'd go to the test day and walk around with my helmet, and got to drive a 935 Whittington's car just to be able to, because I was there for the test day. So I chased that. I chased the Sebring thing. And then when the Miami Grand Prix happened, I knew Ralph Sanchez. I used to sell him shock absorbers. And so he and I was South Florida based, and so he was trying to get that community around it, both the media and the fans and all of the other
folks. We spoke about that not too long ago, about that inaugural Miami Grand Prix and how crazy it was.
Yeah, but I helped Ralph, and so then he helped put a deal together, I got... So, outside of my commitment to Ford, I never knew for sure how long they were going to like me or how long they were going to keep me. I got to keep racing. That's one of the things that I tell these young drivers is, try, adapt. You have to be able to adapt to different things, and you have to put yourself in an uncomfortable situation and become comfortable and competent. And don't crash, don't be stupid, but figure it out. And so I did that as much as I possibly could, as long as the car was safe and well prepared, then I'm in it, and I'm still that way.
Wow. So as we move to mid 80s, what you did with Jack Roush and being a part of that empire, at the time it was an empire in road racing, SCCA Trans Am series, IMSA GTO, and he moved into prototypes as well. Everyone I've spoken to, I've never interviewed Jack, but everyone I've spoken to that drove for Jack, at least in the 80s, some really interesting stories. And with interesting, I'm using air quotes here. Not trying to speak ill of Jack, but I've heard some very great things about Jack, and I've also heard some things that made me shake my head and say, come on, you're kidding me. What was the experience like for you, and obviously with this Ford relationship, but if you're going where Ford is saying you need to go, what was it like entering into the house of Jack?
It was the roughest thing I've ever had to do.
Mm.
We were dependent on each other. You're always dependent as a driver on your team owner. And yet, you know, he knew that I brought up the, I mean, he had his own relationship and he was going to get Ford funding, but he also knew that I brought a lot of that Ford funding. And he knew that I had access. Because over the years, not by design, sometimes by design, but really more by opportunity, I ended up developing some really, really good relationships at very high level at Ford Motor Company, beyond just Ford Racing. I'm a business person, and this was a business.
Well, that's what I was going to say. For every young driver wondering why you didn't get that ride here, why someone else got that sponsor you were chasing, it's not necessarily because you're a deficient human being. Oftentimes, it's relationships. Ones you have built, ones you can rely on. So, to your point, getting to not just know the person who writes the check on the racing side, but actually building a full-fledged relationship with a manufacturer, massive.
Yeah, I mean, I would study, and I still do, I study, you know, it's easier to study it now, where you could go to a library sometimes, or, you know, trying to get who's on the board? Who are the board of directors of the company that you're working with? You know, what's the history of that company? I mean, and again, with Google and, you know, the internet now, it's a lot easier. But it's also, it's business. You have to understand business objectives and business models. And so I approached my career literally from the time I got Ford Motor Company as a sponsor. And even before, I always looked at the business model and see where the fit was. And if I'm fulfilling the objectives, it's always about winning, but it isn't always just about winning. You know, there's a lot of other objectives of what you've got to achieve. And so with Jack, you know, back to that, it was a very tenuous, tough relationship. And
do you think there was a feeling of having your presence, I don't know, it's forced, I don't mean that in a negative way.
That's
but
true.
Do you think it was a feeling of, hey, this isn't my choice, therefore I don't like it?
Jack's a businessman too, and Jack wanted to make the business decisions. And even though, I mean, he didn't necessarily maybe hire directly Scott Pruitt or Robbie Gordon or the drivers that drove for him, the other drivers that drove for him, but he influenced it greatly when he would sit with Michael Kranefuss and they decided who they were going to hire. That conversation didn't occur when I came into the mix.
Mm.
And so I was forced upon him, and that so he wants to be in control, and he wants to control everything. And not only that, I'm not an easy person to control. And so, you know, and I had that leverage, and I'm sure he hated that. And so, I mean, I hired a basketball coach, and I say this with a certain amount of jest, but a certain amount of actual honesty, because if I hadn't, I probably would be in prison because I would have killed him. It was that much energy. I mean, it was that much anger for me to try to figure out. And I realized I'm not going to change him. So what I had to do was learn how to change myself or adapt myself to deal with this and still come out with achieving the objectives that I wanted to achieve.
So give us an example of one of those instances where hiring that. Something that led to the realization that without someone to help me from turning the red mist into choking, give us an example if you can, because you know situations always help paint a picture.
Well, when I found out, but first of all, when I found out, you know, the guys would tell me and the crew, they all crews talk. I mean, they're all on the same team, so to speak, so they all hang out together,
yeah.
Right? Well, you know, we always got the last motor coming off because we had to make sure we got the one that had the least amount of horsepower. Not that there was a huge amount of difference, but so the guys would be always the last load in the car. I mean, so my crews ended up having, you know, to deal with stuff that because they were, yeah, because it was me, you know. And the same with gears, you know. I mean, gears are very important when you're at a racetrack. And be like, mine would always be a little off, and then I could never figure out why I was, you know, my RPMs or whatever were, well, it was like, just deal with it, Lynn. You know, you're not coming off the corner right. And I mean, so there would always be an explanation. And then when I personally knew when I was at Miami that I wouldn't even get qualifying tires. Because you don't need them. I mean, and Leo Mel tells the story, it was at Mid-Ohio that I had Jack by the collar and his feet were not touching the ground.
Wow.
I mean, I was so angry, you know, because I wasn't getting a fair shot, you know. It's not like I wanted anything special or any. I just wanted
equal.
A fair shot,
yeah.
And I'm being judged on an equal basis against the competition. The fans, the corporate people, the media don't know. I mean, they look at all these cars lined up and they look exactly the same. So there were just, you know, so many instances from time and time and season after season that I knew that I was being held back. And that was made you very angry, you know.
Chris Neifel tells a story about watching Jack pull rev chips, and this is back in the day where, before all the heightened electronics we have now, you would have, you know, if whether it was an MSD ignition box or whatever brand, but there were essentially rev limit chips you would put in, and at 8700, 8800, whatever it was, you could put in the chip that brought in a hard cut RPMs for the engine. And Chris tells a story back when he was driving for Jack, Willie T. Ribbs was driving for Jack, of watching Jack pull the higher rev limit chip out of Willie's car and putting in a lower rev chip. Yep. And Willie going out and being slower, not tons, but a couple tenths slower, wondering why a motor doesn't feel like it's pulling that hard. I have no idea. And Willie kind of losing his thinking. Willie's starting to think he's going crazy because he's being told, no, what you're perceiving is not real. And Chris is over in the corner going, why are you doing that to him? So, again, I'm not trying to paint Jack as a bad person. It's just the antics are well known.
Right. And I was just a part of that, you know, and I didn't have the ability necessarily. I went to Pruitt a lot, you know, and Pruitt was compassionate, but not necessarily really helpful. But so I didn't have that ability to bounce it off of the others. That's why I had to go outside, you know, and kind of deal with my own head. And so. Yeah. I wasn't the only victim of all of this, is the point I'm making. And I just, the only thing I can think of is that Jack, it's this control factor with Jack, you know, that and the fact that he is going to decide who is going to be successful and how and why. And I remember I used to tell him, I say, Jack, if I win, it's not because I'm a great driver, it's because you built a great car and you've got a great engine, because he was an engine, totally into the engine stuff. If Scott Pruitt wins, or, you know, Robbie Gordon wins, or these, it's because they're great, right?
You know, it's the old Ferrari and Formula One thing. Yeah, that's great that you won, Mr. Vettel. It's because Ferrari is what won. Yeah. You happen to be fortunate
to
be
sitting. And I never could get Jack to come to that understanding, yeah. So anyway, we survived it, but even to this day, we glare at each other a lot.
Wow. So in 85, you had some fun teammates, and I try and think of folks who can claim to have driven with Bruce Jenner and Bill Elliott the same year. While there, and I realized that maybe the environment was not always as warm as it should have been, you're still around some pretty amazing people, some folks that were very good in your profession as well. For those who maybe only know of the modern version of Bruce Jenner, what was he like as teammate, as a race car driver, incredibly famous for his Olympic, or for his athletic ability and everything that he did outside of race cars leading into it, but I don't know if many people have heard what kind of driver he actually was.
Well, he wasn't bad. I mean, he admitted, he actually talked about it and admitted that he has a hard time concentrating for long periods of time. And we actually kind of talked about it, because almost all of the decathlon competitions are pretty short, you know, in duration. And so he could put some laps together, but he couldn't do that over long periods of time, and he would have lapses of concentration, which could cause some serious problems.
Yes.
So he wasn't a reliable teammate. He was fun to be around. I mean, he was, you know, kind of had a self-effacing kind of, you know, personality, but it was not. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't great. I mean, it was because he wasn't reliable. I was like, oh God, you know, we're going to put Bruce in the car. Are we going to be okay? Not that he was going to be slow, but, you know, are we going to be okay?
And that also, again, brought a lot. If Lynn St. James driving for Jack Roush and part of the Ford family wasn't already something that brought attention to what you were doing, adding in America's Super Olympian, right, I would imagine, brought even more attention. So from a wanting to get results, As nice as it is having someone of his stature there, I have to imagine you're probably going, yeah, that's nice, but I'm here to win races. Yeah. Whoever it is, give me someone that can win.
It actually took a little of the pressure off of me, though, because there was so much attention to him. And that was kind of nice, because within the team effort, you know, I often got more attention, and they used, you know, and, that, and there was some issues. You know, Halsmer was my teammate, and I'm sorry, they can even Robbie and Pruitt and some of the guys in Gloy, and they're like, well, you get all the attention. And I'm like, well, if you worked your ass off a little bit, you'd get some more attention too. I remember yelling at Pete Halsmer, if you told more people that you build airplanes, you could get a lot of interviews about that, because it's really interesting. Oh, I don't want to talk about that.
Wow. You moved after that 85 season in IMSA, rich time for the series in GTO. You'd spent a lot of time in tube-frame style silhouette cars. 86, you get to play in possibly one of the, just about the richest year of IMSA from a GTP standpoint with the Ford Probe. Tell me about that, and I'm going to get to, we're at the, this is not one of those things you want to talk about from an anniversary standpoint, but we're 30 years since one of the craziest crashes ever at Riverside. But before we get to that, tell me what it was like moving into this trillion horsepower grenade propelled GTP car.
Well, I fell in love with Bob Riley, and because he was so helpful, and
I think
such,
we all have.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a superhuman being and so bright, and I learned so much from him. And then I get to go to some of the tests with Ford, and I saw that Probe, and I salivated. I was like, I have to drive that car. I have to race that car. Plus, I wanted to be an overall. I wanted to win overall. I mean, I not that I was an appreciative of winning GTO or winning class, but I wanted to win overall, and I wanted to drive that Probe. It was like the coolest thing, and so. I watched Klaus at the test, and it was actually in West Palm Beach, and I'm like, holy cow, they're shifting like three times in the corner, and this thing is like, it's so hard to drive. So I immediately started really kicking ass in the gym and trying to work out more. And so I convinced Ford and Goodyear to take the Probe to Talladega to go
set
this world's close course speed record.
I'm glad you brought that up.
To convince Kranefus, who was not necessarily one of my best buds either, that was the other guy that I had to deal with, that the basketball coach helped me with. But anyway, to convince Kranefus, I could drive this car, And so, because I was convincing some other people at Ford Motor Company that I should be able to drive that car. And so the fact that that went reasonably well, I don't know how it all shook out, but it made the decision that I was going to be in the car in the 86.
And what was that speed? I'm sure.
Well, we only went 201, which the car should have gone a lot faster,
sure.
But there was some issues of that Zaxby did not quite comprehend what's Talladega. It wasn't just like Daytona, which is what they thought. But I went 201, but I went back in 1988,
yeah.
3 years later with the Elliott's and went 212.577. But anyway, that was sort of, so it was a very big strategy for me to want to go overall and to win that, to be potentially capable of winning the race overall and to drive that absolutely most fabulous, famous, terrific race car.
Yeah.
And also the fact that it was turbo, I wanted to get turbo experience because I just felt that I needed to add that to my, I was trying within the framework of Ford Motor Company figure out what's available that I can add to my repertoire of knowing that I can drive a turbo car.
Because they were moving with the Mustang SVO, they had I think the Thunderbird was turbocharged, they had the Mercure.
Right, which ultimately I did too,
yep.
A few years later, yeah.
So
I just felt that was an important piece of the puzzle for me.
So you get to Riverside, 86, one of the scariest crashes, the scariest crash I'd ever seen at that time. I actually, knowing that we were going to try and record this weekend on the flight out here from California, watched that race again just to remind myself of how different the times were in terms of Hans devices, safer barriers, safer anything. Nope, not a chance. Things built into the car to greatly protect yourself or mobilize your head or nope, none of those things either. So here you are along with two other drivers, in the world's fastest prototypes at a track that is as raw and old school as possible, going through one of its fastest corners, if not, you know, the ridiculous speeds. I remember at the time, there were some idiots who I think gravitated towards you and said, oh, St. James caused that crash. Anybody who happened to watch the tape would realize, no, not at all. But we still ended up with three cars, airborne, fire, yourself in the car upside down on fire in the Ford Probe. I believe it was Chip Robinson who almost ended up,
in the motorhomes.
Yeah, ended up almost, we almost lost some lives among the fans with that car tumbling and ending up just basically on the fence. And Doc Bundy as well, who I think probably got out of things the easiest of all and triggered this whole thing. Tell me about how that crash came together, because good Lord, three prototypes flying, crashing, flipping, and yourself being in a fire. A lot of us held our breath when that happened.
Well, first of all, I don't really know exactly how it came together. All I know is I got hit. I was like, we had literally just come off of a yellow, so green tire, fresh tires, full loads of fuel, and the way I would describe it is kind of tippy-toeing through turn one at this point,
yeah.
Because we just literally had come off of a driver change and, all this refueling and everything. And so I'm like, Chip and I are behaving as we go through turn one.
Chip's on your right.
Yeah.
You're
I'm
about
in the middle,
to apex.
And I'm about to apex, and I'm like, this is cool. He's got room. I got room. We can do this. And then I just felt this bang. I had no idea where it came from. And then it just propelled me into Chip. And the next thing I know, I'm a missile, and that's all I know. I mean, I'm a missile. And then I see all this crap in my windshield. I didn't realize, to be honest, that I was upside down. I was thinking, I guess I just dug a hole or something, because
and
I saw oil and fuel.
And something.
Probably about 140, 150,
yeah.
Something in that range. And then I'm spinning, and I knew I had to get out of there. And so as soon as the car came to a stop, I did push the fire bottle. And fortunately, the door opened. And fortunately, when I released the seatbelt, that was the only, I hit my head,
you know.
And if you watch it in slow motion, and again, this is all on reflection now, that the car takes about a 45, or not about a 90 degree turn where the car actually, the fire comes out of the fire. In other words, the car's in the fire, and then it does this slight rotation, the fire's over here, and the car's over here. I had to crawl through the fire, but at least I wasn't in the fire.
Yeah.
And because I had a couple of small fires under hood, and I ended up kind of burning my lungs, because you tend to hyperventilate in those situations anyway.
Sure.
And so the whole time that I consciously remember is I kept saying to myself, like this little recording, don't breathe, don't breathe, don't breathe,
wow.
Don't breathe. So it was like this computer came in that said, recalled from the past, and so that kept me calm. And as I said, fortunately the door opened and I crawled out, and I saw the guy with the corner worker, I went through a little late, and I walked around and I still wasn't quite sure what happened. And I saw Doc come up, and the fact that he was coming up from behind me, I started to process that he was involved,
If body language was an indicator on the TV screen, displeasure was visited upon you, and there was a little bit of a, what the hell? Yeah.
When we got to the medical center, the infield medical center, we were on gurneys in there, and I heard his voice, and I jumped off the gurney and headed out for, and they had to pull me back.
Wow.
Because by then I had actually figured it out. And so it was so ridiculous. Information afterward is that he was on a completely different, he was laps down, because they were off cycle of pit stops. They had had some mechanical problem earlier on. So he was not with a full load of fuel, he had come hauling ass off of Levin and was trying to get a lap back, and so he made a bad decision, a bad time to be doing that, but he was in a completely different cycle. Didn't justify it, but it explained it.
Wow.
And I was worried, though, to be really honest, Marshall, I was very worried that I would lose my Ford deal over this, because that I felt that I would be blamed, and not only that, I destroyed a car, that was a multi-million or at least million plus. So I had serious concerns that this was going to be the end of my career. And I was very quiet about that. And I remember though Michael Craddock was actually saying to me, because I still didn't know exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And I knew the media was going to be asking me what happened. And I hate it when you say, I don't know. And Michael just said, don't worry about it, don't say anything. And so, and then I had to drive myself to the hospital because they said, you look fine, but you know, adrenaline has a way of masking things. And so I got in my rental car and drove to the hospital in Riverside.
Thanks for the crash. Could you please drive yourself
I was okay. They said, you look okay. And I didn't have anybody with me, so I just drove to the hospital and I called my mom from the hospital to tell her I was okay. And then a week later, when we were at Laguna, you know, that was the back-to-back, and they had the backup car there. And I, God bless Zaxby, I mean, they said, do you want to take some laps? And I did. And I was like on the test day on Thursday, and I'm so glad I did, because that, like, fall, you know, it's like getting back on the horse.
Yeah.
And I will also tell, it's a very important lesson in my mind, is that when I got in the car, strapped in, and I was sore, and I had a neck brace and all that. But as I started to drive down pit lane, I literally saw the accident happen all over again. It was like this replay came.
Wow.
And so I saw all this oil and dirt on the windshield. It was like literally watching it happen again. And I'm going like this, trying to clean the windshield.
It.
But I'm also saying to myself, real time, real time. And I remember the grid marshal standing there going, like, what a wave back.
Waving at me.
Like,
hi.
Like, what are you waving at me for? But it was the best thing that could have happened. And I did find out later through Rod Campbell. He said to me, Lynn, I want you to know that there were a lot of Ford executives here. And the comment that came, he wouldn't tell me from who, was that it really left an impression. They said, Lynn really is like the rest of the guys.
Wow.
You know, it was like, it was the first time they saw an incident like that, or where they put me in the same frame. And so it actually, ultimately, I think it enhanced my image or role within the Ford Motor Company executives, who were those people supporting me. And to be honest, I think I became a better racer afterward, because when you survive a crash like that, and you know, all my helmet was singed, my balaclava was singed, my suit was all singed, but everything did protect me, even though we didn't have all the protection we have now. When you see that all that stuff really works, there's not that you ever think about that, but I think subconsciously you might wonder, you know, is all this stuff really, you know, does it work?
Sure.
And so I think I became a better racer and a harder, better racer, and I think it actually helped my stature at Ford Motor Company.
And again, we're just coming off recently from the Olympics, where while Michael Phelps and some of the American male swimmers definitely did amazing things, but for the most part, it's the American women that I think made up most of the headlines and kicked ass in Rio on our behalf. To hear a woman say, you know, I'm treated equally and considered no more, no less than the men in 2016, normal. Wouldn't think anything of it. 1986?
Not so much. Yeah.
So we are, as tends to happen quite often on my podcasts, we're going to have to do a part two, because there's this whole thing called Indianapolis and IndyCar that I want to get into. And I definitely want to speak more in depth about your foundation. But let's close on maybe two, stay in the world of sports cars, or maybe try and wrap up sports cars and your autobiography. So as you progress through 86, you continue in the Ford family. We see you in IMSA and Trans Am. One of the things that I found interesting back then is your sponsor, Secret, came on board. And I don't pretend to have enough historical knowledge to know if and when the first female-centric sponsor came into motorsports, but I do know that at that time, I always thought it was really cool. That aha, it's not just Joe's Garage or Testosterone Incorporated. Here's a real, you know, Secret was an antiperspirant company, but they did tons of national advertising. They were a really well-known brand, and seeing them associated with you just from the sidelines, I thought that was really cool. Did you regard that as cool, or come on, this is a little bit on the nose?
Do you know how that happened? After the crash at Riverside, I still went to the races just as a representing. And I'm at Mid-Ohio. And I am there just kind of as a person like I am here, you know. And I meet two people. And one is like the head of an ad agency, Saatchi & Saatchi. The other is a big vice president of Procter & Gamble. I end up hosting them just because I have the time and I'm explaining to them all about the different classes because everybody, you know.
Sure.
And they're kind of car guys. And long story short, that senior vice president of Procter & Gamble was the health and beauty division, and that created the dialogue and the relationship to be able to, it still took a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah.
Because it turned out that Ricky Rudd's sister actually worked for a sports marketing company in Charlotte, and of course because Tide and, you know, had been in so all of that work started with me not having a ride at Mid-Ohio, but being at that track and then developing that dialogue and that relationship that ultimately pitched and ended up then, it ended up in the secret deodorant category of that. But that's how that all sort of started.
Wow.
And with a lot of hard work from, I can't remember Ricky's sister's first name, but with her and we got secret deodorant, and then they did an advertising, and they did it, yeah. And then I always said I'd never have pink on my car, but of course they had pink on their label, and I said, that's okay, I'll have pink on my car.
Did that sit okay with you from a necessity standpoint? And again, this is in context of Lynn St. James having just gone flown 50 feet in the air at 150 miles an hour, barrel rolled, been in a fire, gets to the infield medical center, and your first reaction is, where is that bleep sucker Doc Bundy? I'm going to go choke the crap out of him, right? I mean, never been a wilting flower. So, again, that was the other thing where I'm like, cool, a female-related product sponsoring Lynn, but is this too on the nose? Is this, did that sit okay with you?
No, in a way, you're right. I had some angst over that because, I mean, they used to tease me about when I was that radio button for, you know, your deodorant button. And, you know, there was I got a lot of razzing over it. But, you know, I said, get over it, Lynn. I mean, this is a great sponsor. It's Procter & Gamble. And I would go out and visit the buyers. I mean, I even found this out, that when you are a buyer in these, you end up, you can't make an appointment. I mean, when you're selling a product in these health and beauty care, I went with them, with the representatives from Secret, and you have to sit in a bullpen, and the buyer decides when, in fact, that you're going to have access, unless you have a celebrity with you. And if you have a celebrity with you because they want a photo op, you get access.
Uh-huh.
And they were the last celebrity they had was Miss America. So it was kind of like, and I'd go in with them, and I'd get the picture taken, but then I'd ask them how many cases they're going to buy, because I was also this business person. So, you know, I looked at it as it was an opportunity. It was different. It finally really it brought too much attention that it was a woman's product.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I've always said, if we can get new sponsors because of women being a woman, that's better than if I don't want to steal another guy sponsor. That's not going to grow the sport. So how can we grow the sport? We can grow the sport by bringing new sponsors in.
Yeah.
And if I was able to finally do that and it was a woman's product, then it's good. I had to learn, I had to grow into that understanding. I had to grow into that. It didn't initially excite me.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't do it. But I grew into it. And it worked later when I got JCPenney, which we'll talk about in part two.
Absolutely. So on top of everything you've done in American sports car racing, you've made a couple trips to France, too, for the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Tell me about that. So if you are a spectator at your first 12 hours of Sebring, 24 hours of Daytona, and having big dreams, but also visualizing, hey, I can be there. When did the world's greatest motor race and the biggest sports car race, when did that come into your frame as, I need to get to France?
Well, because the 24 Hours of Daytona and 12 Hours of Sebring were the seeds of my passion for racing and road racing particularly, and for me as a driver, the other one, the big one, is Le Mans. And when the Inalterra cars came to Daytona with Christine Beckers and Lello Lombardi, I mean, so this whole, you know, world globally opened up when I started to understand that this 24 Hours of Le Mans was this, you know, bigger than even the 24 Hours of Daytona. Sorry, Daytona. So that was always a dream, but never really a goal, because I had a lot of space to fill to make that a goal. But when I started to have success, at Daytona and, you know, in road racing and in sports car racing, I said, I got to do that. Mm. And, you know, I was already getting to an age, Marshall, that I didn't know how many more years I was going to be able to keep doing this. And I was going to keep being able to get the support. And so Le Mans became very important. And Ford Motor Company had no interest. They weren't doing Le Mans then. And so I had to create that outside of the, I had to create that opportunity outside of my support from Ford. But they were fortunately, as long as it was a Ford powered, which it was a Cosworth. Yeah. And it was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my entire racing career was 1989, going to the 24 Hours of Le Mans in a Spice chassis with a Cosworth and with only Gordon Spice and Ray Bellum, two real veterans. Yeah, I mean, it was like living in La La Land. You know, it was really fabulous. It really was. And I got lots of seat time, and because they go, oh, you go drive.
Wow.
It was tremendous. It was just tremendous.
And how were you received there? Because by that time, at least in North America, you were a very well-known race car driver. Going to Le Mans, tons of drivers there, but you never want to assume that they're looking in to see what's happening here.
Yeah, I didn't really look around much, and Ray and Gordon were great, and that's all I cared about, is that my teammates totally accepted me, the crew that on the cars totally accepted me. I think my times were pretty doggone good, so it was kind of like, let's go racing.
Yeah.
And the media, I mean, you know, there was some side kind of, who the hell is she, you know, but I didn't really remember any other big, you know, issues or anything. So I just sort of slid in. I mean, to be honest, all the publicity or all the attention was around the Hawaiian Tropic girls because they sponsored our car.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like, that's where the cameras are, you know. And I remember when we did the parade, it was so funny how they ride the parade. And I had Ray and Gordon sitting on either side of me, and then the four little Hawaiian Tropic gals are like standing, you know, walking with the cars in their little crocheted bikinis. And the guys are loving it, and all of a sudden they kind of looked and realized maybe they shouldn't be loving it so much. There was a little bit of embarrassment. And I looked at them and I said, don't worry. I said, when you guys come to Daytona, I'm going to have Tom Cruise and Paul Newman with us, and then we'll just see who they're looking at.
Nice. That is awesome. So you had one more return at Le Mans 91.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? And again, and it might be beating the same drum a little bit, but all-female team, some highly regarded women as well. I mean, this wasn't a who can we assemble. This was at the time, if we're talking Desiree Wilson and Kathy Mueller, they were highly respected. And Desiree in particular, she'd done some pretty incredible things. What was it like being a part of that? And I'll also ask maybe the same kind of context. Was there any bit of internal groan of all-female team, really, haven't I got beyond that? Or was it cool to actually get to go race with these women?
Oh, well, it would have been really, really cool had that really come together well. I would have been delighted to be with Desiree and Kathy Mueller. I mean, two really ace shoes. It was just, that was such a disaster. The team, the car. I mean, I got to go to Japan, which was for the test and the announcement. That was pretty cool. But they were so ill-prepared. There was, I mean, if it hadn't been for some of the crew guys from some of the other teams that helped us out, we wouldn't have even made the grid. I mean, my very first lap in practice, the brake pedal fell off. And, Des comes on the radio, I'm having a brake problem. You just get this squeaky little voice, you know, there's no fucking pedal, it's rolling around. I said, I'll get it back. But it was unfortunately, mechanically and the people they had assembled for that team was one of the worst racing experiences I had.
Aero racing team, I believe.
I don't even remember.
AO,
yeah, it was a Japanese gal, and they wouldn't let her run because she didn't. But she put the deal together, and it was one of these weird deals which often happen in racing.
Yeah.
Was I at all negative because it was the all female and because I was with two aces? But it was one of those. I don't talk much about it. I don't even think I got suited up on race day because I knew we weren't going to make it.
You're checking to see if the flight's back or you get the early flight back. Well, we need to wrap up here. I know we were hoping to do this a couple weeks ago at Monterey during the reunion there. I'm glad we found time here. And it also works and coincides with something pretty cool, doing a book signing here in about 15 minutes of your autobiography, which sold out.
Yeah.
That, so it's one thing when you walk into the garage and go, good Lord, I've got 2,000 books and they're taking up all the space. I'm happy for you that the sales have been good. And it's not as if it just came out yesterday, but tell me a little bit about that. And I'm making an assumption here, but I always enjoy speaking with you. I have to assume those who've listened for the past hour have enjoyed them, some Lynn St. James stories. There's a printed version as well that has even more. So just tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's my racing life. It's not my entire life, but it's my racing life. And I mean, it starts with my Pinto and SCCA and goes on up through all the years at Indy. But, I tried to give insight into the people because it's still a lot about the people, as well as what happens when we come in and make a pit stop or when we are testing or, you know, the changes we make on the car and how intricate and critical they are. So it's and every chapter has a life lesson that I've learned from racing that has helped me in life, and so they're called pit stops. So it's just an incredible journey that has the stories. I remember the editor a couple times saying, are you sure you want to say this, some of the things about Roush? And you know, and I'm like, hey, it's just the truth. I'm not defacing anybody or, you know, it's just
this
the truth.
The life
so it has some of the raw stuff, but, you know, none of the real, I mean, there's. I haven't had a horrible life like some people anticipate, you know, being the woman and all that. I've been blessed, actually. And so I think it honors some of my great friends that have been very helpful. And because I've had, believe me, without the alliance and the support of friends who have either prevented me from doing some really stupid things or giving me good advice, open doors, no matter how hard I worked, those things wouldn't have happened. And so I try to credit all of that in there and let people know. So it's called An Incredible Journey. It has been out. It was originally published by Hyperion as The Ride of Your Life, and there were just issues there that I got it back and said, you know, I wanted to kind of correct some of those issues, and it's done, and it has gone well because I've really been making an effort to promote it instead of just having it on my website.
You know,
you can get it on Amazon, you can get it on my website, or anytime I'm making an appearance and, you know, I'm around, I'll probably have some books in my case.
Nice. Well, we have a part two to do, hopefully, as soon as we see each other again on your open wheel career and also your foundation.
And that was Lynn St. James. Definitely encourage you to visit her website, lynnstjames.com. Check out her book, which is really cool, Lynn St. James, An Incredible Journey. And there's also what she does to help young women try and move forward in the sport again with the Women's Sports Foundation. So altogether, really, really cool character and someone who I look forward to capturing a part two. So as usual, thanks again for listening in. Check out more podcasts and other content, MarshallPruitt.com.